Welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast. I'm Lahav Harkov, diplomatic correspondent and senior contributing editor, and I'm here as always with Yaakov Katz, our editor-in-chief. And at home, we are now in the Jerusalem Post office. At home, I have a child who is in quarantine for the third time, second time in less than 2 weeks, and hopefully the last time ever, because we are going into a period of no quarantines unless you actually have COVID. Israel is moving into no green pass, which is what we call our vaccine passport, and no quarantines. So it's an interesting experiment. What do you think about it?
And the no quarantine, basically that this plan, which will affect all of our kids, I guess. My kids, thankfully, they're all vaccinated at this stage. So even if there is someone if they're exposed to someone who's infected, they do a quick antigen test at home and then they go back to school.
Right.
Your kids were younger. We're not yet. But if I understand correctly, the new outline is that they have to take tests every Sunday and Wednesday at home. Right. Is that how this is?
Yeah. And they're supposed to get these tests at school, and it's from birth. So like I have a kid who's 2.5 and he's not public school in Israel starts from age 3. He's in a private preschool and they're also supposed to be getting the tests twice a week.
And that's going to cost a lot of money, by the way. I mean, I don't know. People should be. The government says they're giving 3 tests a kid for now. Right. Or 3 tests a family. But I have 3 kids who will have to be taking 2 tests a week. That's 6 tests a week. Assuming they're not exposed to anyone, which could be more tests. So we're going to be going through a lot of tests every week.
And the truth is, I mean, you already are, right? Because anybody can go and get tested now. But if you want to get tested at home, you have to buy it. But if you don't want to, if you want to get tested by someone and it's an antigen test, there's all these stations you could go to and just do it for free. And you just claim that you are exposed to someone. I mean, I don't know why no one would lie about it, right? But they were already giving a lot of tests for free.
They were giving a lot of tests for free. But anyhow, the whole system is basically putting the burden on the citizen as opposed to the government the way it used to be, which I guess has its advantages, but
and
also
the government says that outright.
Yeah. But I guess it does make sense, right? They teach us how to drive. They give us a driver's license, go drive. They don't sit in the passenger seat and tell us every second what to do. And that's, we've kind of reached, maybe we've matured and we've grown up a little. Your kid, you have one, your oldest is getting vaccinated this week?
Yeah, she just turned 5.
So she's eligible.
Right. And you know what? We really thought about it because we said when there was this whole system of quarantines, we were like, sure, we wanted her vaccinated to make our lives easier. At this point, right, the risks of Omicron, and especially to small children versus the very, very minor risks of the vaccine, like it seemed more or less the same. But we decided to do it. There's always the risk of long COVID. The risks of the vaccine are like really, really rare. And you know what? Like she gets a flu shot every year. If it ends up that a COVID shot's like a flu shot and you have to get it every year, then all right, that's another shot.
You've been giving your kids flu shots since birth?
Yeah. And I also get them. I know a lot of adults don't do it.
I've been getting it every year for the last probably 15 years also. I once was in the States.
Yeah.
And got terrible flu traveling. And I said, since then, every year I get the flu shot. All my kids get the flu shot. But I think that we're a minority in that sense.
I think so, too. I had pneumonia when I was younger. And the doctor said after that, I have to get a flu shot every year, like a severe pneumonia. And I definitely think it's rare. And I always tell people, get your flu shot. Like, it's free. It's easy.
And I think it protects people.
Right. And it protects you. And people die from the flu, like kids especially.
Okay. So you're taking your kid to get the shot?
Well, actually, my mother-in-law is taking her. My daughter hasn't told me this reason yet, but I think she thinks that she's going to get like better chocolate and ice cream from her grandmother than from me.
By the way, probably true.
Probably. Yeah.
Probably true to an extent. But with the end of the Green Pass, which I think to an extent might mean the end of all restrictions on Israel, all that's really left are the tests that people have to take when they come into the country or when they leave the country, right? If you think about it for a moment, right? Flying in and out of Ben-Gurion Airport is going to be the last place that there's still going to be some obligation to do something.
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, except for kids, right? Kids are still getting tested when they go to school.
Right. They will have to take those 2 tests a week, but there won't be any quarantines anymore, right? So finally,
is there not going to be... I guess if you're vaccinated, there's no quarantine after travel
anymore.
Because at the beginning of Omicron, there was quarantine, even if you're vaccinated.
Correct.
It's just so confusing.
Everything's confusing. If our listeners even understand what we're talking about, then that's an incredible thing. But I want to switch gears for a moment and talk about something that I think needs to be said. And I wonder if this will raise people's ire and get them more upset than the fact that we vaccinate our kids with the flu shot and right. with the corona vaccine, because that'll get some, probably the anti-vaxxers who listen to this podcast not happy.
Do you think anti-vaxxers listen to us at this point? I think we've been so pro-vaccine for so long.
Maybe not. Unless they just want to get upset and, you know, this is a good outlet for them to do that. But why can't people just say two words? And the two words are settler violence, right? It exists. It's a terrible phenomenon. We saw videos again on Friday of dozens of masked men carrying bats and throwing rocks at Israeli peace activists, left-wing, definitely peace activists from Rabbis for Human Rights and other organizations, together with Palestinians near this West Bank village called Burin, where they'd come to plant trees and lay out the landmarkings of what separates their land from state land, etc. And then you even see one guy who takes this big gallon of like gas, right, and pours it on a car, and throws a match or lights with a lighter and sets the car on fire. Not a single person arrested. We're talking in the middle of the week already, no one has been arrested. What the hell is going on?
And not only that, well, no one's been arrested, which is bad enough. I haven't heard anything from our prime minister about this.
Neither our defense minister.
Yeah.
Well, you can make an excuse now has COVID, so he's at home in quarantine, although he didn't manage to put together a nice video right before Shabbat, which was hours after this thing had happened on Friday, yeah, and to send that out to everyone all smiley. So unless he's, you know, hopefully he's doing okay, it hasn't taken a turn for the worse. No one, we haven't heard that, but where's his voice, which hasn't been heard? And he is, as defense minister, the man who's in control or responsible for the West Bank and for what goes on there. I just don't. And you know what? The settlers themselves, or the residents of Judea and Samaria, Israeli communities in the West Bank, all these different words and semantics, you know, that you have to use, but they should be the ones who should be calling this out, because it harms them. You have, what, 400,000, 500,000 Israelis who live there now, Jews. They're, for the vast majority, law-abiding citizens. They're good people. They serve their country. They pay taxes. They follow the law. This is a fringe minority, and it's just dirtying their entire name, and you don't hear them.
It's not just dirtying their name. I mean, in practical terms, like, it's going to make their lives more difficult. The more this happens, the more, you know, law enforcement's going to have to be involved, you know, and I hope, I don't hope their lives are more difficult, but I hope law enforcement will be involved, because it's a terrible thing that's happening. And we've had a lot of recurring, you know, attacks in recent weeks and months. So they really should be speaking up and saying that they want law enforcement to come and stop these people.
They should want law enforcement, but also but I don't say, you know, you mentioned the prime minister, you mentioned Bennett. So a few weeks ago, when there was another incident, and then the deputy minister of economy, who also happens to be a former deputy chief of staff, Yair Golan from the Meretz party, so definitely on the far left, tweeted out that these are subhumans, right? Which was a bad choice of word and language, and he got slammed from every possible direction. Bennett tweeted at the time, and I looked this up the other day, that this is a blood libel, he said. It's a blood libel. The residents of Judea and Samaria are the modern pioneers of the state of Israel.
Well, it wasn't just that, though, because, I mean, that's a really bad statement, right? And it has, like, as people pointed out, it brings back Holocaust.
I agree.
But weeks before that, the public security minister, who's in charge of police, it's like Homeland Security, he tweeted that he had had a meeting with a senior
Victoria
Nuland, who's from the National Security Council in Washington. I don't remember her exact title, but and he mentioned that they discussed settler violence in the meeting. And even then, Bennett came out and he said that, you know, it's, I don't remember if it was Bennett or sources close to Bennett, but they said more or less that the settlers are being painted with a broad brush. You're calling 500,000 people violent. That's not fair. Okay. I can understand that, but then speak out against the violence, right, even if it's the tiny group of violent people who are spoiling it for the rest of them.
No, and what Yair Golan said, I think, was despicable. You shouldn't call people
anybody
subhuman,
yeah,
right? You know, especially considering our past from the Holocaust. And we're speaking just a few days before International Holocaust Remembrance Day.
Yeah.
But with that said, these are criminals, these are terrorists, these are anti-Semites, whatever you want to call them, these are perpetrators of crimes that need to be prosecuted to the full extent of the law. And instead of having a clear message come out from our government, they're not saying anything, and they're playing these political calculation games, which I find to be pathetic but also dangerous, because what it means is it's setting ourselves up for this to continue. And the fact that people can't just say those two words, settler violence or Jewish violence or Jewish terrorism, whatever two words you want to choose, is the problem, I think. And why is that, do you think? Is it politics?
I do think it's politics. I do think that people look at it and they think that they're... I mean, I just think that there is a sort of substantive difference between that and what happens with the Palestinians against the Israelis, where from the Palestinians, there's some level of support from the Palestinian Authority. There's incitement in their textbooks and in their sanctioned media, and there's the pay for slay payments. And so that's even when it's a quote unquote lone wolf Palestinian, they come from this like system of, you know, anti-Israel, anti-Semitism, whereas they feel like the settlers or just these people who go out and are violent against Palestinians really are like their own little group of people that are separate from society. But I don't think that that's a reason not to comment on them. I mean, when a horrible crime happens, people say things. It doesn't mean that all of Israel is full of horrible criminals.
Yeah. You know, what I remember, this is 2014. Remember there was the young Jerusalem boy, Abu Khdeir,
yeah.
Muhammad Abu Khdeir, who was picked up by Jews in a car, was taken to a forest nearby Jerusalem, was murdered, and his body was burned. And that was part of what happened that summer, which then led, there were the three boys
were
kidnapped before. Yeah. This was their act of vengeance, and this led to Operation Protective Edge, or the Gaza War of the summer of 2014. So all of this was happening at the same time. Every single Israeli politician, pretty much, I think everyone across the board, condemned what happened to the young Abu Khdeir. Legitimately so, right? Of course. And I think that what we saw then was that that's the difference. And you saw that, by the way, with the Duma incident too, right? Remember when that guy's still on trial, but when they threw a firebomb into this home in Duma and killed a number of Palestinians. Everyone also condemned that.
But you know what? Even then, then President Rivlin said, people of my nation turned to terrorism. And it became this huge thing that the whole right wing was really mad at him, that he was like calling all of the Jewish people or all of the Israeli people terrorists,
right,
which very clearly was not what he meant to say.
Because I think that there's a clear distinction between, unfortunately, yes, there are rotten weeds among Israelis and Jews who have to be rooted out, but it's not state sanctioned and it's not on an industrial scale. And unfortunately, on the other side, it is state sanctioned because you have that pay for slay and you have the Palestinian Authority that's encouraging this, whether they're not they might not be encouraging it with their words, but they're encouraging it with the paycheck, right? That they're paying these families.
I think they encourage it with words. I mean, we've published a lot of articles about their textbooks and about their state media.
Yeah, no, for sure. And so it's definitely state sanctioned and it's on an industrial scale, unfortunately. So you can't compare. That's why I think we need to condemn this to make it clear that we are different. And that's what pains me about this whole thing.
Yeah. And I think it's crazy that there are no arrests. I mean, it's all on video.
And they know where they're coming from. They're coming from that outpost up there. They're coming down the mountain.
Right.
Just go back up there and find them. Right. Should not be. Ain't rocket science.
Yeah.
Right.
And they got rid of some of the like illegal like caravans that are up there in the outpost. But apparently it's not even the one that these people came from. It's just some other family.
So, Lahav, on that beautiful, really optimistic note, right?
Yeah.
I want to move to another topic with you. You wrote a story the other day that Israel is considering weighing its options on the Russia-Ukraine situation. Right. So Russia, by the time people hear this, Russia might have already invaded Ukraine. That's something that is expected to be imminent and happening any time now. But how does Israel fit into all of this? And why would Israel even care?
Well, Israel doesn't want to fit into all of it. Israel wants to be left alone and to be able to be neutral.
And be friends with everyone.
Right. And, you know, so the U.S. is Israel's most important strategic ally. And the U.S. is backing Ukraine here. And right. Ukraine's... you know, sovereign territory from further invasion by Russia, because we should remember that Russia has been occupying Crimea since 2014. They've already been invaded by Russia. But anyway, but Israel also has a strategic relationship with Russia, especially because of Syria, right? The Russian military has a major presence in Syria. Israel continues airstrikes in Syria against mostly Iranian targets.
And by the way, just let me open parentheses from what a lot of people don't know is that when Israel attacks in Syria, it notifies the Russians before it does so.
Right.
Right. I mean, literally, they pick up the phone and they call some Russian guy in some base somewhere in Syria and say, hey, we're now going to be doing this, that, and the other, and this, that, and the other place. You should know.
Right. And so that the Russians can clear out.
Right. And that there's not some confusion, and they know that what these Israeli planes are coming for, et cetera.
Right. And there have been a couple of incidents. It hasn't always worked, but there's this deconfliction mechanism, and that's really important for Israel as well. You know, but I don't, were we, I'm not sure that we were doing that back in 2014, but then Israel kept neutral too, because then the idea was sort of like, why do we need to be involved here? Like, we have good relations with both countries, and Israel does have excellent relations with Ukraine. And there's large Jewish communities in both countries. Right. So what Israel would like is to not have to get involved. However, there's already, you know, when I talk to people in the foreign ministry, they said, oh, no, there's no pressure. And people sort of understand our position that really we shouldn't have to pick sides. That being said, earlier this month, when Secretary of State Blinken spoke with Foreign Minister Lapid, in their statement after the call, the State Department wrote that they talked about Russia and Ukraine. And then last week, when Putin and Bennett spoke, Putin said that they talked about NATO and about Russia and Ukraine.
Bennett did not say that, though.
No, no. And right. Same with the Blinken-Lapid call.
The Israeli readout did not include anything about Ukraine and Russia.
Right. And my understanding in both of those cases is that the Americans and Russians brought the subject up and the Israelis listened, let them have their say.
You had another story, which is on the same topic, of how Vladimir Zelensky.
Yes. I think it's pronounced a little differently.
Vladimir?
Yeah, it's like a Vladimir. Yeah.
Well, I apologize. Who happens to be the Jewish prime minister of Ukraine.
Yes.
Reached out to Bennett and asked him to mediate with Russia at some point.
So apparently he had first asked Bibi.
Okay.
And Bibi really didn't want to.
For the similar reasons, I think, of what you were just saying.
Right. Like realpolitik reasons that like he probably knew that Putin would have none of it. And so it would just put him in a bad spot with Putin. So they brought it up like on the lower level. It wasn't directly Netanyahu to Putin. And it didn't go anywhere. And then after Bennett became prime minister, 4 months later, or a little less than 4 months later, he was going to Sochi, which is this nice resort town in Russia where Putin has a summer house, and he was going there to meet with Putin. And after it became public, like the day later, Zelensky called Bennett and brought this up again and asked if Bennett could bring it up. Mm-hmm. So Bennett briefly...
That was the weekend that Bennett got stuck in Sochi.
Correct. Right? Correct. Which I've been to Sochi, and it's like the Tveria of Russia. It's like, it is a resort town on the sea. It's not the greatest place to spend the weekend.
Okay.
But anyway, so Bennett brought this up to Putin. He said, you know, he didn't bring up what Zelensky had suggested, a summit like between Zelensky and Putin in Jerusalem. Bennett didn't say that, but Bennett brought up something along the lines of, you know, I could mediate. The Ukrainians suggested that we mediate. And Putin said not interested, and that was it. And it hasn't come up since then. Because, you know, I just don't, it just doesn't seem like something worth Israel's like political credit with Putin.
Also seems like a bit above what Israel should be doing to an extent, no?
Right, because Israel's, I mean, in a way you could say because Israel has like no direct involvement here, you know, like as opposed to say like the EU, right?
Right, or the United States.
Or the United States, right, that Israel's not in NATO. Israel doesn't border with any of these countries. So they are truly neutral in a way, and they have good relations with both countries. But it isn't the kind of thing you see happening in Israel, like ever.
Yeah, we don't mediate between Russians and their neighbors.
We have problems of our own.
Right. People should be meeting between us and our neighbors, maybe. And they've tried over the years. Russia, by the way, right, on that note, Russia, maybe what Bennett should have said is, we'll go to your peace summit with the Palestinians if you come to our peace summit with the Ukrainians, and they could do a quid pro quo. How do you see it playing out from Israel's perspective? We're just going to try to be careful, get along with everyone, and keep it safe.
Well, and this is the disadvantage of recording a few days in advance, because between now and when the podcast comes out, Putin could do something.
Well, the war, fine, but what is Israel? How does Israel figure?
No, I know, but
figure?
I'm saying that it really depends what happens, right? Like, to quote President Biden, right, there could be a minor incursion, which is bad for Ukraine, but if it's not like a full-scale war, or if it's just like a big cyber attack, right, then Israel probably, there won't be any pressure, and Israel probably won't have to get involved. If there's a full-scale war, which, I mean, we should take in proportion, it's the worst for Ukraine, but it's bad for Israel in the sense that there's probably going to be pressure on the American side for Israel to say something against Russia. And then if I had to guess, Israel will release some sort of statement, but it won't be very strongly worded.
Our two interviews this week are with Oded Revivi, who's the mayor of Efrat, one of the largest settlements in the West Bank. Oded is unique in the fact that his voice has been heard on the issue of settler violence, and he's been was maybe one of the only people, I think, right, Lahav, to condemn or to at least call out what was seen last Friday.
He certainly was one of the only leading figures that I saw. I can't say that I was, you know, keeping track, but it definitely stood out.
And we're happy to have him on to talk a little bit about, more about that and how he views what's happening. And we also spoke with Carice Witte, who is the head of Signal, a Sino-Israel global network and academic leadership, to talk about how this week Israel and China marked 30 years to formal diplomatic relations between the two countries. Here we go. Oded Revivi, it's great to have you with us on the Jerusalem Post podcast. Oded is the, as we said, the mayor of Efrat, a longtime leader of the Judean Samaria Council, and for a long time also served as the foreign envoy. So was the person who was basically the face of Judean Samaria and the Jewish communities, also known as the settlements, to the world. And Oded, we're talking to you because on Friday, when there was that incident near the Palestinian village of Burin, you were really the first, I would say, so-called settler leader who came out and basically condemned this violence, said this isn't what the way of the Jewish communities of Judea and Samaria, but that there was silence for most of your colleagues. So first of all, I'm just curious, how do you view what's happening? Because unfortunately, we're continuing to see incident after incident after incident. This is causing damage to the state of Israel and to the settlement enterprise, I would say. How do you view this whole situation?
So I think the situation is very complex, and I think that's why the responses are very complex. But generally speaking, about the video and the visual pictures that we started seeing, if in the past they were mainly done at night, secretly, without leaving any trace of evidence that could lead to the people who actually did the acts of violence, And it was something which wasn't as visual. You could see the damage done afterwards. You could see the graffiti that was done afterwards, but you didn't see the actual incident taking place. And I think what we've started seeing in the last few months, which is really an indication of what's been happening in the last 2 years, is a somewhat a shift from maybe even acts which were done by smaller groups, but definitely more disguised groups, to something which is happening more openly during daylight, no fear of having footage of it. And I think that's basically the major change, which is also brought to the different coverage in the media of these incidents.
And to some extent, it seems that the incidents are becoming more severe, right? In the past, it was, you know, once in a decade or so that you would actually have physical violence. There would be a lot of sort of like graffiti, but the incidents of physical violence seemed rare. And it seems like lately there's a lot more rock throwing and sort of direct violent confrontations.
I don't know to say if they're more severe or less severe. Mm-hmm. I think we all remember very severe incidents that did happen in the past. The fact that they didn't always were concluded with an investigation that actually put the people responsible mm-hmm. behind bars is a completely different aspect and issue. But it's definitely things which are being done way widely and more out there without having the fear of doing it at night and not being caught or videoed with it.
I would think, right, that if I was one of the leaders of the Asia Council, like yourself and like many of your colleagues, I would be the first to come out and condemn and say this isn't our way and this isn't who we are and this is a rotten weed from among us. But obviously, you know, anyone who, whether I think in Israel, you know, maybe the extreme left would think a little differently, but I think anyone who's obviously on the right or even in the center, even in the moderate left, understands that this is a fringe, tiny minority of people who live in the West Bank. This is not the majority of the 400 to 500,000 people who live there. And but it causes a terrible name for all these people. It makes it seem to the world like this is
a plague almost, like it's happening all over the place, but it's not. And that's why I would think that everyone should stand up and say this is a problem. But unfortunately, we're not hearing them.
So I think here's my second part of the answer, which is the problem of responding and how do you actually respond? So on the one level, you have mayors who would say, you know, nobody is condemning acts of rape or terror or violence happening in Tel Aviv, because everybody understands that that's not the responsibility of the mayor of Tel Aviv or the mayor of Jerusalem. It's the responsibility of the police, the any other security service that might be relevant, and we expect them to deal with it. The other challenge with responding to such incidents is when you actually respond, you basically echo the actual incident. And if you want to deal with it, you want to try and hash it. I decided to go publicly against it because of basically what you've said within your question, that I think it is important to differentiate and say this is not any sort of a representation of the vast majority or even a large group of people. We're talking about a very small, violent and a very, very minor group that needs to be treated. But I think also my choice to actually condemn it and go out publicly against it is because I think there's a much greater picture. And I think we are, the residents of Israel all over are starting to feel more and more that there is lack of governing by the government, by the security forces, by the police, by the army. And it is true when we see it in the mixed cities, it is true when we see it in the Negev, and it is also true when we see it in Judea and Samaria. And I think my approach was really to try and create a louder voice to start taking responsibility and dealing with it. And specifically talking about this youth, there is general understanding that nobody is really dealing with it. Nobody is dealing with it in the circles of security and law enforcement, but nobody is also dealing with it with the educational system or the social services. And even programs which were funded by the government in the past have basically closed down. And there is this problematic youth. There is this violent youth which are not obeying rules and regulations and law and order. And it's the job of the government to start understanding that you can't ignore these problems and you have to deal with them.
So what do you think can be done? I mean, this phenomenon of hilltop youth, and they're not all violent, but it seems that the violence comes from them. You know, it's kids who are sort of teenagers, mostly, who are like runaways and, you know, just sort of pitching a tent, trying to start their own sort of settlements on different hilltops and living their lives like that. And as you said, that they have like no educational framework. They're just very, very ideological, sort of fervent and run away to do these things. And what do you think the solution should be? How should they be dealt with?
I'm not even sure that all of them have an ideological background or justification for their acts. Some of them might get caught in it just because of the fun, just because they want to feel strong, just because right. they want to get attention. We're not even talking about people who do it because of ideological reasons. I guess, obviously, that there are some people who are motivated religiously or ideologically, but I think the truth of the matter is it's an issue of national government. Something has to do with all the circles involved. I'll just give you one insight, which basically yesterday I found out, was that Roy Sharon on Channel 1 all of a sudden reported the jump in number of cases. And I spoke to him after the interview that he gave, and I said, what's happening? And he said that it's been just 2 years that the Shabak have started looking into these issues. Up until now, it was issues which were only treated by the police. So we see that even between the security forces, there's no coherent understanding as who is dealing with it, what sort of measurements need to be taken. And when you understand that acts of violence and breaking the law are happening without the organs of the country, which are supposed to deal with it, are not synchronized and dealing with it together, then we can't even understand or expect to see the educational system or the social services actually treating it properly. And on times like this, when everybody is really bothered with COVID and now with the snow, you see that issues like this all of a sudden develop and grow larger to become national issues. And unfortunately, I don't see at the moment the government sitting around a table and saying, okay, this is the problem. This is how we're going to split the treatment and who is taking responsibility in actually leading the program to make sure that these issues don't repeat themselves.
So basically what you would like to see, if I understand correctly, is you want more police involvement, more Shabak involvement. You think they just need to step up?
I don't think it's just an issue of force and security and police and Shabak. I think definitely you need to examine from the beginning, you know, why did these kids drop out of the educational system? What went wrong? How come the social services weren't able to actually assist them and make sure that they don't deteriorate into becoming law offenders and violent people? At the end of the day, there also needs to be legal measurements against people who do those things, so people will actually be afraid of being so open and public and doing these acts of violence. I can tell you another thing which I've discovered exploring this issue is that a lot of the violence completely on the other side, within the Arab cities, the police found out that some of the youth who are doing the acts of violence, they are not afraid of the security cameras around the places where they're actually doing their acts of violence. And it was very weird. You know, you thought that the cameras would deteriorate them and prevent them from doing it. And then they discovered that actually they want to be filmed because they enjoy the fact that the films that they are starring in actually appear on social media. And then they repeat it in TikTok. And then they actually get a wider coverage of their acts. So sometimes we think of the problem and solving it in old mechanisms. We think that if it's actually being recorded, it will prevent people from doing it, where we actually see that they actually look for places where the cameras are around. So what I'm saying is that it has to be something which is coherent with all the different ministries in the government, and to try and come out with a program.
Odade, but come on. You're a veteran of a long time mayor, politician. You want the Israeli government to come out with a clear, coherent policy on an issue? I'm saying that sarcastically. But I mean, come on.
No, Yaakov, I think at the end of the day, we know one another long enough that I completely understand where the question is coming from. And I think you're completely accurate. But I think just like you said, you know, these pictures are causing Israel damage in the international community. These pictures, at the end of the day, create a picture of a reality in Israel which is far from normality or a widespread issue. And when people think of it at the end of the day as something which is local and very minor, and we're not going to put the funds to deal with it, it can actually, at the end of the day, meet us in the United Nations or meet us in the Human Court of Justice without understanding how such small incidents have built up to international issues. And unfortunately, if the state of Israel won't deal with these issues, so we'll be confronted with way bigger problems than what we are facing at the moment.
So I, a few weeks ago, wrote about people in Bennett's office talking about the Biden administration being obsessed with settler violence, that they ask about it and complain about it all the time. And of course, the Biden administration is also not a fan of construction of new homes in Israeli communities in Judea and Samaria. I wanted to know, from your perspective, as someone who's sort of in the government in Judea and Samaria, where do things stand? How much is that pressure having an impact on the situation on the ground?
I don't know how much the Biden administration is having pressure on what's happening in Judea and Samaria. I think there's enough pressure within the Israeli government to actually put the whole issue of Judea and Samaria, building in Judea and Samaria, into a complete standstill, because there's absolutely no understanding between or no agreement between the different parts of the coalition to know what the policy that they want to lead. Regarding the American administration, I would only say that when the state of Israel doesn't have a clear policy as to where they want to lead or how they want to govern a specific region, then you have outside forces like the American administration taking advantage of it and really asking questions which are leaving the Israeli government a puzzle. And then when you hear a minister who is meeting a senior official from the administration, that was the question that she asked in the meeting. So, you know, instead of putting it in perspective and saying, you know, we've got way bigger issues, we're dealing with bigger problems, that all of a sudden becomes the major topic of discussion, where they could have used the valuable and precious time that they have to discuss way more important issues. But that's, again, where you put the focus and how much energy you actually put into the important and big issues, and how much the small, sometimes loud incidents distract the attention and cause you to spend the valuable funds on it instead of it.
Odette, have you felt under the government now, that's the Bennett-Lapid government, while working with Biden, have you felt an effrat? Which, if people don't know, but I'm sure people do know Efrat, just south of Jerusalem, one of the larger towns in Judea and Samaria. Have you felt a freezer at all, or more difficulty in approving construction projects?
Definitely there's a sense of a building freeze. Things are not being developed. Infrastructure is not being promoted and invested. But again, you know, it's 6 months, 7 months since this government has come into power. I don't think that is the problem that we are facing. I think the problem that we're facing is that we have a government who is basically clear that because of its different parties taking part in the government, they're only going to agree on what they agree, and they're not going to discuss what they disagree. And then you have an issue which you can't say we're not discussing it, because Judea and Samaria is a large area of the state of Israel. It has 500,000 Jewish residents in it. And you can't say, oh, I'm not discussing these issues because they're in dispute. And when you don't discuss issues which are in dispute, there's no vacuum, and there becomes a reality which builds up. And I'm not trying to justify the acts of violence that we discussed in the beginning, but part of the frustration that I hear from people who decide to take the law into their own hands, and again, I completely disagree with them and I condemn them, but part of the reason that they're giving themselves justifying taking the law into their own hands is that they're saying that they don't see enough enforcement of the law by the Israeli government, whether it's against illegal building in Area C or taking over state land and issues like that, which, again, the government is saying we're not dealing with it because it's a hot potato. So you build up frustration amongst people that decide to do even worse things and take the law into their own hands. And that's the worrying situation.
I want to ask you about something you just mentioned, the illegal construction by Palestinians in Area C. So this week, the government announced that they are going to demolish Khan al-Ahmar, this illegal Bedouin encampment outside Kfar Adumim, finally, after many, many years. However, they're going to rebuild it 300 meters away. And so some people were complaining that this doesn't count, that they, I'd like to know what you think about it.
So, you know, for us Israelis, there used to be a joke, which was an expression, don't do Salah Shabati. Salah Shabati was basically a new immigrant to Israel who tried to raise donations and used to plant a tree, and then he covered it with a hat and get more donations to plant another tree, as if this is the first tree in the forest.
Right, and our listeners might know it actually won an Oscar back when the movie came out. It was a black and white movie, I think, in the early 60s. But anyway, yes.
So that's the joke, right? That we're trying to fool everybody. And I think the people of Israel, after four rounds of elections, after seeing such cynical politician promises being basically turned around in 180 degrees within minutes. People are starting to be fed up with such solutions that are not really dealing with the problem. Again, I voiced maybe an unpopular voice, but I said that when there is a building freeze in Area C for the Palestinians and that they don't get the right to build, and there were hardly, if any, any building permits to the Arabs in Judea and Samaria for the last 10 years. So it's like a pressure cooker. It will blow up somewhere which is not planned and not convenient in the worst timing for us. And all of a sudden, you see a lot of illegal building in Area C. Why? Because there's no legal mechanism that Arabs can actually build in Area C. So instead of taking our prerogative as governing body, as the government responsible, as the ones who are actually managing this region and decide these are the areas where the Arabs are going to build and make sure that it's connected to infrastructure and make sure that you are directing in which path you want to govern this region, we find illegal building happening all over. So there's illegal building happening all over. So the Jews see this illegal building happening. So there are two types of responses. One, okay, so now let's restart building illegal outposts and all sorts of structures because that's the only way that the government is allowing us to build. Or going and protesting against that building, which is done by the Arabs. So again, it's an example of where there's lack of government and definitely lack of policy. So now with Khan al-Ahmar, so what are they saying? Oh, the Supreme Court has told us we have to demolish it. But it's too controversial demolishing it. It won't look good in the eyes of the international community. There are families which are living there, which we don't know how to explain that we're demolishing their houses. So we'll say, okay, we're demolishing this house, but we're building you another house 300 meters down the road. That's not policy. That's maybe solving this specific issue. And I think residents in a state.
But Defense Minister Gantz did approve like thousands of homes to be built for Palestinians in Area C recently. So is that something that you support?
So first of all, let me correct you. It wasn't thousands. I think it was 1,000. And I was again, Yaakov would probably can show you up in the memory box that I was one of the, maybe even the only one who actually praised the government for actually making that decision. But just think about it, okay? It was 1,000 units after 10 years of not building. I can tell you that in the small city of Efrat, 15,000 residents, when 1,000 units were approved, they were sold in no time. So we can understand that for the whole population, the Arab population of Judea and Samaria, 1,000 units is really nothing.
Drop in the bucket,
Yeah, and again, it was only, you know, I think it was really put out in order to reduce criticism that Gantz is allowing Jewish building in Judea and Samaria. They said, oh, I'm also allowing Arab building in Judea and Samaria. But again, it's not policy. It's not making decisions. Where are we going to build? Where are we going to allow them to build? How do we want to develop this region? And it's really just sitting on...
Because I think no one wants to make a tough decision. But I want to ask you, just before we wrap up, one easy question. I'll throw a snowball your way. So you're the mayor of Efrat. We're talking Wednesday, midday, big storm coming. You're going to get a lot of snow, no?
Yeah, well, I don't know who your listeners are. In Israeli standards, a lot of snow is 40 centimeters. For people in the States, 40 centimeters is a regular day.
But 40 centimeters here shuts down the country, right? We won't be able to move if there's 40 centimeters.
So basically, that's the situation. At the moment, the sun is shining, but already people have made decisions yesterday that today they're closing the schools at 1 o'clock. Why? Because the storm is on the way. At the moment, the predictions are that the snow will start falling only in the evening. So there's a question, why did people already close schools earlier on today? It will be fun. Everything will look clean. It will be coated in white.
And as the mayor, you'll have to clear the roads, right? I'm guessing that's part of the job, right?
Yeah. And again, I mean, it's an excellent example of how Efrat has managed to build extremely good relationship with our Arab neighbors. And we have already a drill that when the snow starts falling, we call our Arab neighbors that they come with their heavy equipment. They're the ones who clear the streets for us. We pay them for that. And it's, again, just one of the corporations that we have with our Arab neighbors, which we are proud of, and we definitely try to share it to the international community.
Fantastic. Well, Oded Revivi, the mayor of Efrat, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
So this week we have Carice Witty, the founder and executive director of Signal, which is the Sino-Israel Global Network and Academic Leadership. It's an Israeli policy organization focusing on Israel-China relations. And we're speaking as Israel and China mark 30 years of diplomatic relations. So you've had your own sort of celebration. You've had your own sort of conference. But what would you, if you were going to give these 30 years a grade, what do you think? What do we get for China-Israel relations?
Well, that is such a great question. First of all, thank you very much for having me. It is a momentous occasion, considering that Israel was persona non grata with China, which supported the Arab boycott of Israel for decades. So it's definitely a big achievement. I'd say overall, we probably get a 7, even an 8 at certain times, all things considered. The first half was less auspicious because the relations were very focused on intelligence and defense sales, intelligence sharing, and Israel selling defense equipment or military.
Right. I think, Carice, it's important to mention that the part of the way the ties began was through defense sales, right? That's kind of what was the inception of it, no?
Sure. In the early years, that's what interested China in Israel in the first place, was that Saul Eisenberg was flying around among the different countries in the region and managed to connect Israeli arms sales to China with the tacit support of the United States. And then after we had official relations, the U.S. gave an official nod to that until 2000, when, I don't know if your listeners are familiar with the Falcon and the Harpy crisis, where we had sold early warning system to China and in the mid to late 90s. And then they had made a very serious down payment of about $300 million. And in 2000, as the deal was progressing, the U.S. said, oh, you can't do that. And one thing led to another. The deal was canceled. Lots of fallout, both with Israel-China and Israel-U.S.
And the plane made its way to India in the end.
Yes. And well, we know how that turned out. Israel-India arms sales are in very good shape now.
Well, so that was a major event, I would say, in the history of Israel-China relations. And so how did things recover since then? Because relations are pretty good.
Right. So the problem back then was that all there was those two areas, a little bit of sales of water technology and agricultural technology. But when that fallout happened, there was nothing to fall back on. No people to people, no academic, no nothing. When I started looking into this relationship, back in 2009, I was shocked to see that there was nothing going on between Israel and China. I mean, I was really surprised. And when I looked inside China, what connections Israel had and what was going on, I found there were some Jewish centers because Judaism was ancient and it was kind of kosher, relatively speaking, given that Israel was kind of the, in quotes, bad guy affiliated with the United States. And we were not welcome in most university settings. The media was anti-Israel. However, in 2010, when China became the second largest economy and decided to become the world's innovators, it was very clear to me that it would be moving towards Israel eventually. And at the time and still, China's in great need of the energy that's in this region, which meant all of this area would become more and more important to China. And yet it was also clear to me that China didn't really understand the region because it's got such a different history, such a different culture, you know, 100 years of humiliation, which stemmed from the mid 1800s when China became known as the sick man of Asia and
the opium wars and everything.
Exactly. And but the British and taking over their the customs houses on the coastlines and the opium wars, etc. So China had that recent memory and was not a confident country at the time. And that I think that's part of the reason why it was so willing to support the Arab boycott. It didn't really have its own opinion.
But it's also a communist thing, right? I mean, yes, Russia originally was one of the first countries, I think the first country to recognize Israel, but in the very soon after, right, Israel's relations with the Soviet bloc were no longer existed, and China mostly went along with what other communists went with.
That's true. You're absolutely right. And the combination kept us apart. I think we're the only country in the world that had zero relations with China. I haven't actually looked into it as a study, but observationally, I believe that, you know, even Albania had more relations with China than Israel did.
Carice, your recalling of how the relations began with the defense sales, I just have to tell you that in the mid-1980s, when I was a kid growing up in Chicago, my mother had this relative who lived in Israel, who was working at the time for Israel Aerospace Industries, Tassi Avirit. And he would come every once in a while to Chicago, and he would always bring us kids chopsticks. And he would say I was getting them on these flights and, you know, throughout Asia. But only in later years did I discover that he was actually one of those Israeli defense contractors who was traveling to China discreetly, and he would come to the U.S. to then fly from the U.S. to China, right? Because they weren't able to fly directly through from Israel.
Yeah, that's very cool. Interesting, they had to go all the way to America to go to China.
Because if I recall correctly, I think that people, based on whatever second passport they had, they went to those countries and then flew from there. So if you were, you know, Austrian, you flew from Austria. If you were British, whatever. But I'm curious now. So if you look at the last 30 years, what we've seen is really amazing trade relations, right? So Israel in recent years, ever since the Falcon incident that you mentioned, stopped selling weapons. There was then, and then there was the story with the drones. But Israel pretty much stopped, does not sell any weapons to the Chinese anymore because of U.S. Resistance to that and opposition. But there is a ton of trade, right? There's a ton of import, export. Where do things stand right now?
Not only, I mean, you're right. We're in the billions of dollars. The Chinese and Israelis officials are always quoting to celebrate the 30th. We went from 50 million to 11 billion, 13 billion a year. That's true. It's okay. I can't say it's amazing, just because approximately 70% of that number is purchasing from China. And on the export side, the vast majority is Intel, Israel selling to Intel China. So I can't say we've made a huge success in sales to China. On the other hand, exports. On the other hand, there is a lot of investment money that has flowed over the years. Again, not competing with the U.S. or Europe in percentage, but certainly a significant amount. But also, I think it's important to note that the people-to-people interchange has taken a 180. Before COVID, there were over 100,000 Chinese visiting Israel. The government was enlisting Chinese-speaking tour guides with incredible incentives because there was so much demand. Hotels were making adjustments for Chinese guests. And then, of course, academia, most of the universities have some kind of cooperation agreement with more than one Chinese university. The Technion established a Technion in southern China in Shantou. There's just been a tremendous amount of academic cooperation on our part. We established the field of Israel studies at the university level in China. We are doing that now in 20 different universities. And even in COVID, those classes are continuing. So there's a lot of exchange, and then science, technology, and business, of course, on all levels.
But there still is, Carice, a lot of suspicion, right? We see all the time the issue of the Chinese company that's running the new port in Haifa. If the Americans warning Israel of any Chinese involvement in 5G networks, Chinese companies building light rails and tunnels, and Americans warning about that. So there still is a lot of suspicion with regards to China.
I think the word still, I think it's more like newfound suspicion. There was not any suspicion. I mean, maybe you had a couple of security people who were suspicious, but there was no suspicion until the last couple of years. Well, almost none until the last couple of years, and sparked by U.S. pressure. I would say that the big problem that Israel has on every level, from business to government to politics, is China ignorance. There is almost no understanding of China as a country, as a culture, and the cultural intelligence of Israelis, excuse me for saying, but it's not high, being sensitive to the difference that China is not America, it is not Europe, it's not even Russia. It is a whole animal unto itself, and it needs to be understood on its own terms if you're going to do well. So all that list of things that you just said, the port, the light rail, each one, is it really a threat? I mean, you need to know what China is, what it's looking for, what it's trying to achieve, what are its vulnerabilities and needs. And in the end, if I may say, what Israel needs is a policy. We need a comprehensive policy, if not a full strategy, in how to deal with China. And we've been saying this for years. The reason is because if you know China and you know how to deal with it, you know how to set a policy, and then the Chinese know where you stand, more or less. The Americans understand that you are savvy and smart in how you're dealing with China, so they're not putting as much pressure on. And you yourself know the value of what you're selling. For example, look at the food tech incubator in northern Israel. The tender was won by Bright Food, which is a Chinese state-owned mm-hmm. enterprise, which set up its own consortium in order to be in front of the deal flow, as far as I have heard, of food tech.
That I think brings us to what I think part of the big issue is and the security concerns are, right, which is that in China, all of these companies that are coming in and bidding on important infrastructure for Israel are, you know, to a certain extent, state run, have strong connections often to the Chinese military, have operations in Iran at the same time as they're bidding in Israel. So how do you think that Israel should be handling these bids from these companies?
Well, a more robust foreign investment review committee would be extremely helpful and a very, very good step. There is one now, but I think that it needs to be strengthened and perhaps broadened. And certainly, and not targeted to China per se, but of course, addressing all foreign investments and perhaps all investments that are related to any kind of sensitive infrastructure in any way. I have to stress that if there was an across the board seminar for the government on China, so that everybody in the government, that's politicians, staffers, officials, if everyone had a little bit of sense.
Our problem is that it changes every year.
You're right. It does change, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't do it. I mean, a lot of people work on getting an understanding of the U.S., and the U.S. is certainly very, very important, but it's not the only important place. China is looming larger and larger in our region. China's everywhere in the Middle East. Syria just signed on to the Belt and Road Initiative. Earlier this month, I think China sent a new batch of COVID-19 vaccines to Syria. They're in huge projects in Egypt and, building the second city, the second capital there, and establishing manufacturing companies, which is great for Egypt and very important. They are 60% of all of China's exports to the entire Middle East goes through the UAE. Everyone's read about the UAE co-developing drones with China and possibly taking on China's 5G with Huawei. So there's a lot of things that Israel needs to be paying attention to in the region when it comes to China. And it's impossible to assess anything accurately unless you know a little bit about China.
So, Carice, where do you see things going forward from now? The trade relations will continue. Do you see any changes to security relations? Do you think that will continue to be frozen, or is something also possible to change there?
You want me to predict, or you want me to say what I hope will happen?
You could do both.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate that.
You've lived in Israel long enough to be pretentious and think that you know exactly what's going to happen, like most Israelis do.
Right. Well, I actually am not like most Israelis. And as far as it wouldn't be what I know is going to happen, what I believe is going to happen, unfortunately, is that we'll probably continue on the same trajectory of trying to walk between the raindrops of China and the U.S. and only do what we think the Americans will allow us to do, and make mistakes with China that hopefully don't become too large, but for the time being mainly involve missing important opportunities for Israel to gain not only greater revenues, but also political capital that could be used for strengthening regional security, perhaps. I think that all of those things are possible, but they require a comprehensive policy and understanding China. Two simple things to say, not simple to do, I understand, but they would make all the difference and put us in a much stronger position. But
so
right now, a business is not going to end with China. The U.S. is not going to drop an iron curtain, and it's not doing it for itself. And the interaction between China and Israel, the business and investment interaction, will evolve at worst case scenario, according to U.S. Guidelines.
So I want to ask you also about this increased partnership between Iran and China. They've signed this agreement for 25 years of cooperation. And the original proposal at least included defense cooperation. What does that mean for Israel? Should Israel be concerned about that?
I think Israel needs to be concerned about everything that China's doing in the Middle East. Is that of particular concern? Of course, Iran's position in the face of Israel is unusual, but the Chinese do not want Iran to have a nuclear weapon, and they do not want to see Israel suffer the threats, the result of the threats of Iran. So on the one hand, I don't see them empowering Iran intentionally in ways that are problematic for Israel.
Right.
I do see them empowering Iran unintentionally because, but then the U.S., you know, also does. I understand that the U.S. arranged for the U.N. dues, Iran's U.N. dues to be paid. So, you know, it's very hard to say that Iran is going to benefit less from the U.S. than it is from China. I think right. If the U.S.-China relations had not deteriorated to such an extent, that deal would not have been concretized, in my opinion. They delayed and delayed and delayed. And then when they saw that there was not much to be done with the U.S., they finally signed it. I don't know how much of it will actually be carried out.
You know, I think that the problem is, like you said, that Israel lacks a clear policy on what it wants to do with China and the type of way the directions wants to take that relationship. And that tends to, by the way, just be a problem across the board on many different issues. So it's not unique necessarily just to Israeli-Chinese relations, but it has to do also with other matters that pertain to Israeli foreign policy, security, domestic policy, etc. But let's hope, Carice, that marking 30 years of formal diplomatic relations is also an opportunity for Israel to finally decide what it does want from these relations with the Chinese. And on that note, we'd like to thank you, Carice Witta, from the Signal Sino-Israel Global Network in Academic Leadership. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the Jerusalem Post podcast. If you enjoyed it, please tell your friends and family. You can find us on all the major podcast platforms. And please rate us on Apple Podcasts. Give us 5 stars. You know we deserve it. And we'll be back next week.